Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. Thank you for listening. I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode, where you're going to find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. I'm joined today by Dan Huger, Acton's librarian and a research associate, and contributing editor to the Acton Institute, Emily Zanotti. This week, we'll discuss a new way of administering the death penalty in Alabama and Hindu nationalism and the Ayodhya Temple. But first, let's go to the Rio Grande, which is where there are thousands of migrants, people seeking asylum, illegal immigrants. I think all these terms are applicable because there are distinctions and delineations to be made in the groups of people who are coming over. We, as I'm sure listeners of this program will know, there is a bit of a crisis going on in this country about this problem, that there are a lot of people who are coming up through Central America, across the Texas border, and into the United States. A lot of them you have heard about perhaps not just because their entry at the Texas border, but because of some of the political actions, some may call them stunts, that Governor Greg Abbott of Texas and Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida did. We talked about on this program last year, where Abbott has been busing, flying a lot of these migrants from Texas to places like New York City, Chicago, places that have declared themselves a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state. That is going to become relevant in a little bit here. And then, of course, Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida flying some of those migrants, interestingly enough, who did not, of course, enter in Florida, but came into Texas, were then sent over to Florida and then by Governor DeSantis up to Martha's Vineyard, which I think the takeaway from a lot of people on that was that there was something kind of gross and icky about it. But it did seem to work from the perspective of drawing some important and much needed attention to the issue that was going on. So last week, I will read to you here from a Axios article, Divided SCOTUS Grants Biden Administration Request to Cut Texas's Razor Wire. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday granted the Biden administration's request to vacate an injunction in the Texas Razor Wire saga. The high court sided with the Department of Homeland Security for now after state officials had constructed a wire barrier to prevent migrant crossings. The justices granted the emergency appeal by a 5-4 vote, clearing the way for Border Patrol agents to remove razor wire fencing along the U.S.-Mexican border. Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh dissented. The decision is the latest in a legal battle between the Biden administration and officials in the Republican-led state, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Texas officials installed miles of barriers using barbed wire and buoys along the Rio Grande near Eagle Pass in response to record numbers of migrants arriving at the border. The Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Texas over the barriers last year. Texas sued the Biden administration in December in an attempt to stop agents from removing them. Governor Abbott, we will put this in the show notes as well, released a letter, the rhetoric of which is probably more heated than the actual nature of the case that we are discussing, you know, talking about a broken compact between the federal government and the states strikes me as unhelpful and incendiary rhetoric, but also very much representative of the time in which we are living, in which heated and incendiary rhetoric is the tradecraft of the day. But coming back, and Emily, I want to go to you first on this. The thing that is interesting about this to me is one, a good opportunity to point out how poorly reported upon and how poorly understood the actions of the Supreme Court actually is here. So this the ruling here, and it's not really a ruling, as I noted, and I will read it again from the justices granted from Axios, the emergency appeal by a 5-4 vote. It was a vacation of an injunction that was barring the federal government from removing this razor wire. So again, poor understanding of what actually happened here. They have said that they, you know, federal agents can cut down this razor wire, but they haven't barred the state of Texas from doing all kinds of other things. Texas, I'm sure, will continue to do all kinds of other things. But the thing that is weird about it, when you look at it from the perspective of American history, right, is the idea that, you know, the federal government can enforce federal law in the states, but they cannot co-opt the states and, you know, whether it be the National Guard or any of the other entities of the state in order to enforce federal law. But what is interesting about all of this is, if go back to the sanctuary cities point, the whole reason that sanctuary cities are essentially legal is that local law enforcement officials can decline to cooperate with the feds. What's weird here is for the federal government, for the Biden administration to get its way, they would essentially have to co-opt, nationalize the Texas National Guard and order them to stand down, which is weird, right?
You have everything about this case is crazy, because ultimately what the case hinges on is Texas is saying that the federal government has a responsibility to enforce the border. It has acknowledged that. We know that, you know, from an originalist perspective, and everybody's just piling on to Amy Coney Barrett about this. But if you're an originalist, literally the preamble to the Constitution says provide for the common defense. And that is generally accepted to mean enforcing the borders, whether that's immigration or military. Texas is saying, because the federal government has not done this, we are allowed to take this matter into our own hands. The federal government has abrogated its duty. We are going to come in with state level authority. The only thing that was in question in last week's abrogation of a preventative order. So basically it was just restricting the federal government Texas National Guard had applied for an injunction to, or Texas, the state. See, even I'm getting confused.
I know, right?
Texas, the state had applied for an injunction on the federal government to prevent them from taking down razor wire that has not yet been put up. So in some cases it's speculative. In some cases there is razor wire, but it all depends on where the razor wire is located and on whose land and whether it's in the border, this small area of land that we consider a border, or it's on the Texas side. If it's on the Texas side, they can't touch it. If it's in the border general area, then that's what's in dispute. So Texas applied for an injunction to stop the federal government from taking down its preventative measures located in the border zone. A federal court on a district level granted it, circuit level upheld it. The Supreme Court said, in part, this is speculative. We don't know how much the federal government's going to take down. We don't know if the federal government's even interested in taking down. We don't know where this razor wire is located. If it's on federal land, I can't prevent them from taking down the razor wire. So that is generally, then we get into the separation of powers thing where they're saying now the federal government has a right to enforce or not enforce and make those decisions in that border zone. And you cannot, as a state, go into that border zone and take it upon yourself to enforce the border. Now, there's a bigger question, right? Because Abbott is going to send the Texas National Guard to the border. We see other National Guards thinking about possibly going to the border. All of these states that are piling on are now saying, look, we want the federal government to enforce this in a way that they don't agree with. So the question at hand overall is whether states can sue the federal government to force them to enforce laws that maybe the federal government has made a decision not to enforce. And that's executive branch and separation of powers and all this good stuff that is right there in the Constitution. So as a constitutional litigation attorney or former constitutional litigation attorney, I really can't wait to see this. But really what happened last week wasn't anything major. although it did provide them with a really great PR moment.
Yeah, it wasn't major from a legal perspective, but I think it certainly was legal from a political and an optics perspective, right? Because if you look at public opinion polling data on questions about immigration and especially illegal immigration, in general, the American people are like, yes, we should welcome immigrants, but no, we should not just have people crossing the border willy-nilly.
Not this many.
Correct. And not this many and not in this manner. You know, I go back to the old, if anybody used to enjoy, as I did, Dennis Miller's HBO program. I think the joke was it's like America. We want to welcome people in, but, you know, sign the guest book on as you pass through the door is really all we're asking from you. So from an optics perspective, just the idea of federal government officials cutting down razor wire on the southern border. And again, I this is why I want people to separate out in their mind to a certain extent the question of what you think the ideal immigration policy for the United States should be. I have my opinions on it. There are people out there like former Trump aide Stephen Miller or Mark Krikorian at the Center for Immigration Studies who have a much more hawkish and desire to lower the number of legal immigrants coming here than I do. But, you know, the line that I've stolen from Jonah Goldberg, because I think it's a good one, is at this point in time, my desired immigration policy is to have one, because we do not seem to have one in this country. We go back, Emily, as you were talking about this legal case. There was another one that I remember from 2012, Arizona, where they were essentially saying the same thing. And if I remember the outcome of that case correctly, it was essentially to say the enforcement prerogatives of the federal government reign. But what again is weird about it is the enforcement prerogative of the federal government, both then and now, is not to enforce it at all, which is, I think, why all of this seems so bizarre to everyone.
If what happening in Texas is also happening in Arizona. Arizona is considering sending its National Guard to the border. It is considering doing more to enforce this on a state level. And they're not really getting the same heat because they have a more moderate Democrat governor. So you don't see it happen as much. And Abbott is really gung-ho about handling this, and they've been really aggressive about it. So has DeSantis. DeSantis is also in a high immigration state, though by water, not by land. But what you're seeing this is in the context of two things: a presidential election where immigration is on the table, and where at least one of the people, presumptive nominee Donald Trump, is extreme on immigration, or extremely to one end of immigration, although in his first stint as president, you wouldn't have known that because immigration kind of fell to the wayside and didn't have a policy then either. But you also see it in terms of what's happening in Chicago and in New York and in other cities where overwhelmed Texas authorities are putting people on planes, trains, and automobiles and shipping them to cities that have said, well, it's these people. And that's in part Texas, but also the federal government. Here in Tennessee, there was one plane that landed in the middle of the night full of immigrants who had run afoul of the federal government. And, you know, Marsha Blackburn and Bill Lee showed up at the tarmac and said, no, absolutely not, turn this plane around. And they did. So it's the federal government that's doing this too. So you actually have this issue where people are suffering from an overwhelming illegal immigration at the border, and then a fight at the border. So it's just, it looks like a national mess instead of looking like what it is, which is a bunch of individual, weird, legal, executive, legislative problems that are all coming to a head at the same time.
It is a weird, weird mess, and it's an absolute mess. And there are a couple of reasons for this. Chief among them is that there is a backlog of 3.3 million in our immigration courts. This is a system that literally cannot function. This is 10 times more than the backlog was in 2012. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. One is we have an extremely tight labor market in the United States. We need labor. And people respond to incentives, and there are jobs here. Another is the demand for America outstrips the supply. The sort of country we have with its legal institutions is the most amazing place on this planet to live. And if you look at countries very similar to the United States and their legal structures and their legal order, if you look at Ireland, if you look at the United Kingdom, if you look at Australia and you look at New Zealand, you have similar amounts of foreign-born peoples in those nations. You have actually a great deal more in places like Canada. The difference is all of those countries have systems in place where they can accommodate that situation. They don't have backlogs of 3.3 million cases. We are living, we talked about this in a previous episode of Acting Unwind when we talked about some of these caravans. You have people, migrants, coordinating via WhatsApp as to the best routes to take, as to entry points. You have increasingly sophisticated human smugglers doing this sort of thing. This is a enforcement will continue to be a more and more difficult problem, as a lot of these people showing up at the border aren't even from Latin America. You have people from East Asia. You have people from South Asia. You have people literally everywhere in the world. You have people from Europe showing up because they want to claim asylum, because we've established a right to asylum that is nothing more than a legal fiction because we cannot process these claims.
Yeah, it becomes essentially
the system's so overwhelmed.
It becomes essentially magic words, right? So like you show up at and the people who are showing up have been well instructed in the things that they need to do, the incantation that they need to say when they arrive on the other side of the border. It's like, you know, I claim asylum. I have a legitimate fear of going back to where I came from. And you have exactly what you described, Dan, where you have a backlog in the courts that is impossible for these courts to move through in any kind of expeditious way. The federal government and even I think in some cases the state governments do not want to hold them there. So these people are essentially given a summons to show up at some point in the future, released out into, you know, into the country, and in most cases do not show up there. You know, I personally am very dovish on immigration. I would like to welcome a lot more people to this country than I think probably the majority of those polled publicly would be comfortable welcoming. I recognize in that sense that I am out of line with the general sense of American public opinion on this. But one of the reasons why I don't like seeing what is going on at the southern border right now is because it makes it more difficult to persuade people that we should be a country that welcomes more people here legally. And there are a number of things that are going to be necessary. I do think one of the things that I wish more hawkish people in immigration would grapple with more is the incentive structure that is created for people to come here in the manner that they are currently coming here illegally. And that is I will find it and I will put it in the show notes. The Reason magazine did a really great flow chart probably 10, 12 years ago now.
Oh, yeah. I think I still actually have a copy of that magazine.
Yes.
It was so good.
It was great because the, you know, basically the point of it being is if you are a low-skilled or what we would call unskilled, which is, I think, an unfair term because these people do have skills. We just not in the way that we typically talk about skilled labor. You have, if you don't know anybody, you're not related to somebody who is already here in the United States. When people say, you know, come here through the legal way, it's 125 years. It's roughly 125 years from the time that you would apply to be able to come here to when you would actually be granted some kind of legal status, if not citizenship. So
we've also had this problem where the legislature, both state and federal, has completely abrogated its duty on immigration and sloughed it off to the executive. So even what happened under Trump, you can say, oh, you know, we had stemmed the flow of illegal immigration under Trump to some extent. That is because the executive introduced Remain in Mexico, which said that once you are given that piece of paper that says you have an asylum date, you cannot come into the country. You have to stay in Mexico. That forced Mexico to interdict on its own southern border, because that's where those caravans were coming through. And Mexico said, we will drive you back to Honduras. We will drive you back to Belize, wherever you have come from, or you can apply for a work permit here. There is no ability for you to go into the United States once you get to that southern border. So you've got to figure out something while you're in Mexico.
Yeah.
That works very well, but that was an executive order. The other thing is Title 42. We stemmed the tide of illegal immigration by saying you cannot come here because the risk of spreading COVID is too high. Now, we know at this point, everyone's got COVID. So there's no real reason to keep Title 42 in place, but we still have it because we're still saying we need to put a cap on some of these illegal immigration numbers. And so the Biden administration is acknowledging that this is a problem, but they're also saying, look, as long as Title 42 is in place, we have some executive function on immigration. So we're doing great. But really what it is it's the legislature's job to tackle this. We can't just grant amnesty to 11 million people, although maybe somebody like me would like that. I can't say, you know, this is that executive's job. The legislature itself needs to decide what to do on immigration. And it's been pushing this off to the executive, which doesn't really function that way.
The other problem that you can add on top of that, and I want to take everybody back in time, hop in the DeLorean with me and go back to the year, I believe it was 2006, where this was one of the attempts to get a bipartisan, what we called comprehensive immigration reform package, moved through Congress. And I recall only a few years ago, an interview with former President George W. Bush, who was asked about that experience. And people expected the answer that he would give on, like, what killed comprehensive immigration reform. Because we'd been through another attempt at that later on under the Obama presidency with people like Marco Rubio being the spearhead on some idea of comprehensive immigration reform. That had failed as well. And then we see 2015, 2016, the animating issue that immigration turned out to be for Donald Trump. So everybody expected George W. Bush to say, well, it was the conservative grassroots. Those were the people that really killed any chance of comprehensive immigration reform. His answer was not. Do you know who whose feet he laid the blame? Chuck Schumer. Because Chuck Schumer decided that he would benefit more, his party would benefit more from the political issue of immigration still being live, then they would benefit from any kind of a legislative package that was going to address any of this. I think we see this reality transparently obvious now, laid across our current politics, that both sides benefit more from having it as a live issue than they would from having any kind of, and you know, this makes me, I have a lot of opinions that make me unpopular, but one of my unpopular opinions is I think we would have been better off in general had either of those two comprehensive immigration reform packages passed, even knowing the kinds of things that people I'm generally more inclined to agree with on the political right didn't like about them. But having Congress take some kind of an action would have been better than what we have currently been living through. But we have this problem very much pronounced now that I don't think anybody really wants to address it. And you see the political reality of this laid out very clearly, because now that we know that it's almost certain that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee for president, the political incentives for Joe Biden to be as dovish as possible on every question about immigration are weighing incredibly heavy on him. And I don't know how you escape that political problem.
Or do you escape it when it comes to global policy? Because we had talked, Dan had mentioned about Europe, but what's happened in Europe is there is an unfettered immigration into places like Italy by sea. Those people then make their way into London, they make their way into Paris. Both the UK and France and a lot of these other nations, including Germany, have very strange immigration laws, and that you can come there, but until you've proven yourself as French, as British, as German, especially French, you have to basically stay in a ghetto. you cannot take welfare, or you have to, I'm sorry, you have to live off welfare. You really can't get a job. You're kind of stuck there all day. And that's where this radicalization happens, that's sort of bubbling up in European cities. And so all of a sudden, everybody sees these massive pro-Palestinian marches in Europe and places, and they're wondering how this happened. Well, they imported people. They said, you can come here. They processed them, but then they put them into these ghettos, and now they've radicalized. And so you could never quite win on immigration, because it really does impact everything. What happens if some of those are sleeper cells and they've come in from the Middle East and all of a sudden they're bombing something? You have a lot of these bizarre ethical, moral, and political questions that are all tied up in this, which makes it very difficult.
All of those political considerations are right. I mean, it's difficult to solve. But if you look at, if you look at places like Canada, like Australia, like New Zealand, the United Kingdom, I go back and forth on. There's different policy issues there, and they're still adjusting to sort of a post-EU life. But there is a very, very easy way to do this, is you set up a criteria of what you would like to see most, and you assign it a point value. And everybody's funneled in, and you add up everybody's points, and you decide how many you're going to let in, and you let the top point earners in. There are functional immigration systems in developing countries with institutions very much like the United States that operate on those principles and operate very successfully. You know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, they do not have this sort of chaos. And it's not because those aren't desirable places to be that people do not want to get into. People very much do. And they do successfully, because there's a rules-based system for how they can do that. And it's also enforced. This is very simple.
Who says they're moving to Canada when a Republican wins,
yeah,
finds out very quickly that you actually have to, and I this isn't a direct quote, but it's a paraphrase, you have to contribute to Canadian society. You have to be useful to Canada in order to move to Canada. And some of those of us who grew up in Michigan know, a lot about Canada, actually. But you can't just move there. You can't move there like you can in the United States. And everyone sort of figures this out right after an election in late November, when they want to move to Canada because Donald Trump is president.
Yeah, the one thing we need to add in as we continue to monitor the situation is that the reality of this is that the dignity of thousands upon thousands into the tens of thousands, into the hundreds of thousands, into the millions of people really is also relevant here, that there are people who are – if they are not coming here as having actual asylum claims as the law currently allows for in the United States, there are people who are seeking a better life, who are seeking opportunity, who have dignity in and of themselves. And you know, coming up with programs, I think like some of the reactions to what you were describing, Dan, is that like something about it feels icky to us. That like the, you know, on one hand, I think people are generally torn about this. On one hand, I think people understand that maybe, you know, theoretically it would be nice if we could just welcome everybody that we want to, but we see practical reasons why we think we can't do that. But coming up with a system, coming up with a way to decide who we're going to welcome and who we're not going to always feels kind of gross to everybody. And as a result, we get people kind of paralyzed, and we get political people, political leaders kind of paralyzed into inaction about it, in not just because of that, but also because of the political incentives. But I think we should keep that in the forefront of our minds when we're having these conversations, that these are human beings with worth and dignity that we are talking about. They're not just some kind of widgets that are causing a problem on the southern border. They're actual human beings.
As long as the demand for America exceeds the supply, and I want to see the American experiment replicated as much as I can throughout the world, as much of our institutions as can be replicated, rule of law, respect for human dignity, all of these things that we take for granted, that will help. But until that happens, on this side of paradise, we have a decision to make, which is we either decide a sort of orderly system by which to let a certain amount of people in, or we embrace the sort of Matt Yglesias 1 billion Americans, because that's how many people want to be here, because that is how incredible of a society we have created. And nobody wants to make that choice. You know, it's, you know, Matt Yglesias chose that title for his book because it is scandalous, even to, and provocative, even to folks who very much want to see increased immigration. The reality is most Americans have a number less than that in mind across the political spectrum. And there are ways to adjudicate that, but we need political leadership for that to happen.
It is kind of funny because you reminded me of the, I think the financial rescue package in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis was something like $767 million. And one of the actual reasons why they ended up with that number was because one of the numbers was thrown out. It was like, it needs to be more than $1 billion. And the pushback from Paulson at Treasury was, it can't be more than $1 billion. People will freak out if the number is a billion or more. So it ended up being like $737 million or something like that. Or is, do I have billions and millions wrong? I can't even remember anymore. I think this is probably correct. Like, all of this becomes monopoly money at some point. With the way we're treating the currency, I don't know that I'm necessarily wrong about all of that. But let's move on here to our second topic, which is one that Emily brought to my attention. Kenneth Eugene Smith on Thursday became the first prisoner known to be executed by nitrogen hypoxia. It was the second time Smith, who was convicted in the 1988 murder of Elizabeth Sennett, had been strapped to a gurney in Alabama's execution chamber in Atmore. A 2022 attempt to execute Smith by lethal injection had failed, pushing the state to find an alternative method. Though Alabama officials said execution by nitrogen gas was a painless and humane method, Smith's attorneys and a slew of advocacy groups decried what they said amounted to using Smith as a test subject. The top human rights official at the United Nations warned that death by nitrogen hypoxia, quote, could amount to torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Smith was pronounced dead at 8:25 p.m. local time. Nitrogen, so then under the banner here in this Washington Post piece I'm reading from, what is nitrogen hypoxia? Nitrogen makes up more than 75% of the air humans breathe every day. However, the odorless, colorless gas is only safe to inhale when it's combined with oxygen. Otherwise, it becomes toxic and can have harmful effects, causing the, quote, inability to move, loss of consciousness, convulsions, and death, according to the U.S. Chemical Safety Board. Nitrogen hypoxia, which has been used in some assisted suicides in Europe, depletes the body of oxygen, causing major organs to shut down. Yet the method used in Alabama deviated from that method often used in euthanasia. Instead of using a hood or specially designed bag, the nitrogen in Smith's execution was administered through a gas mask. Smith's lawyers argued that the untested method could increase the likelihood of something going wrong. Leading up to Thursday's execution, some advocates warned that the unproven method could lead to grim and horrible outcomes. One more section of this piece, because I think it gives good context here. Why is nitrogen hypoxia being used now? Lethal injection, in which up to three drugs are administered to stop the heart, has been the primary method of execution since it was first used in 1982. But the past decades have been marked by gruesomely botched executions, legal battles, and growing difficulty in states obtaining the drugs. Pharmaceutical companies have, in recent years, blocked their drugs from being used in executions. The drug shortage left some states, quote, experimenting with new drugs and drug combinations to carry out executions, resulting in numerous prolonged and painful executions, according to the Death Penalty Information Center, a nonprofit that provides information and analysis on death penalty issues. Other states considered alternative methods once deemed inhumane, including firing squads and electric chairs. Three states, Alabama, Mississippi, and Oklahoma, have approved nitrogen hypoxia as an execution method. But until Thursday, no state had attempted to use it. Emily, what sticks out to you about this story? Why did it come across your radar?
came across my radar because I saw a lot of Catholics arguing about it. The church itself has been back and forth on the death penalty. It sort of approves it in principle, but not in practice, largely because it's a finality. Like, you cannot repent if you have died, if the state has killed you. So while it recognizes that there is sort of a generalized right of the state to put people to death, the last several popes, beginning with John Paul II and Evangelii Vitae, have said that the death penalty as it is currently is just not okay. And this kind of drove that point home. It's not clear whether they administered the gas incorrectly, or he's sort of a superhuman that could tolerate it, or whether it really doesn't. We don't necessarily see this, see the assisted suicides that happen in those chambers that kind of look like eggs. These are the chambers that they set up for people in Europe. We don't visualize it, and there's a reason they don't want people to see what happens. This is the first time we've seen that nitrogen gas in public like this, and it took him 25 minutes really to die. It was very gruesome for people to watch. And in this case, the family of the victim actually said, at this point, he's been in prison twice as long as our mother was even alive. And we don't feel that anybody really wins with this death penalty, especially since he had already been subject to it previously and they messed up the IV. So he didn't actually get the drugs. Everybody seemed to think that Alabama was kind of trying, making this person a guinea pig. And really, we shouldn't be doing that to humans. So there was a lot of ethical concerns about this death penalty case. You mentioned the firing squad and the electric chair. Those are actually chosen deaths. So if you live in a state where you have the firing squad as an option, you can choose the firing squad rather than lethal injection. In this case, he did not get to choose that he would be the first person in the U.S. executed with this nitrogen gas method. So there was a lot at stake here. And also in the last few weeks, there were some last minute appeals to the Supreme Court. And members of the Supreme Court said, unfortunately, we can't really step in and stop this. All the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. We're really just the last step in this process. So it did make news on a number of levels.
The contours of this debate in the United States are always interesting. There are sincere theological arguments against the death penalty, particularly within the Roman Catholic tradition, but also other religious traditions. What our actual process of how these public arguments take place in the United States ends up fixated on issues of method and issues of suffering and cruelty, precisely because we have a constitutional arrangement that makes cruel and unusual punishment something that we agree not to do. In fact, the death penalty was once in this country illegal on those grounds. That was overturned. But it colors, I think these are very important issues to debate. It always disturbs me how centered they become on the grisliness and the horror of these things. Now, there is a real, those issues need to be examined, and methods of execution need to be interrogated, but the way that it happens in public, online, in places like Twitter, and those sorts of things is not helpful. And a lot of advocacy groups against the death penalty fuel this sort of imagery being around for public consumption, because that is the grounds in which this at a constitutional level gets decided, is that there is a political arbitrage opportunity by focusing on the grotesquerie that I'm very, very uncomfortable with.
Yeah, there's something weird too, as I was reading this and recapping some of the ways that we have gone away from administering the death penalty, everything from hanging to firing squads to the electric chair. If your only way of thinking about the electric chair is because you saw the movie The Green Mile, then I can understand perhaps why you think that that is such a terrible and barbaric way of doing it. The irony here, though, is if you read a lot about this and you hear the stories of the way that lethal injection executions have been botched, the likelihood of those other methodologies being botched is a lot lower. And, understandably, there are some people who have actually petitioned to be able to, if they're going to be executed by some of these ways that we deem have decided over time. Deemed to be cruel and unusual, which are actually less cruel and, frankly, considering the history of the world, pretty darn usual. Where I come at this from is probably where I am at my most libertarian. I don't think the federal government is competent to deliver the mail effectively. I certainly don't want them to be the ones deciding what federal or state governments to be the ones deciding who lives and who dies in these cases, because just a simple law of averages is going to tell us that if you look at all the people who have been executed in the history of the United States, we got some of those wrong. Those were not people who actually committed those crimes. And while the deprivation of freedom that comes along with incarceration, you're never going to be able to fully make up for having wrongly done that, you can at least make attempts to make amends for that, which you can't do when you've executed the person. And the pushback that I typically hear on all of this is you're saying somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer shouldn't have been executed. It's like, yes, if you point to all of the easy and obvious cases on this, they're very hard to argue with. I understand how unpopular it will be to be the person arguing, actually, no, Jeffrey Dahmer should not be executed. That is not the meaningful conversation that needs to happen about this. It needs to be about the people that you've never heard of before. It needs to be about the people that are never going to make the headlines like a Jeffrey Dahmer or a John Wayne Gacy kind of case is going to make. The problem is not the things that we can all agree on. The problem is the ones where there's a lot more disagreement, where there's a lot more of a possibility that we may have gotten it wrong, and that at some point in the future you're going to need to try to, if we did discover that we imprisoned somebody wrongly, and there are plenty of examples of this throughout the history of this country, and especially just within the last number of years, as true crime podcasting and all of that has drawn more attention to a lot of these stories, this is it is something that you can't undo. And I am not comfortable with the level of certainty that needs to go into all of this. But if it is going to exist, there is something that has always struck me as bizarre about the, I don't know what the term would be, like almost, safety conscious way that we go about executing people. Like the idea of the alcohol swab before we put toxic chemicals into your veins is a little bit strange. I once was allowed to, in my freshman year of college, quote from Dennis Miller's HBO show Rant on the death penalty, that I believe the line that I quoted was an appeals process that drags on longer than Porky Pig singing Hey Jude. We provide people a lot of opportunities to litigate these things. And I understand some of the frustration that goes around all of that, that we don't actually move towards executing people when we decide we're going to. They appeal and they appeal and they appeal. And after it's exhausted, again, the case that we're talking about here, the murder was committed in 1988. And finally, we've gotten to the point of execution here. If we're going to do it, we should probably be a little bit more stark and clear about the methodology that we are doing it in. It is unsurprising to me that a lot of drug companies do not want the products they make associated with the death of people. Not shocking to me at all. So we either need to have a serious conversation about this where we decide as a country to go back to some of these, quote, more barbaric ways of doing it that are actually, I think, in many ways less barbaric than the kind of hyper-medicalized way we're going about it now. But my preference would be to just get rid of the death penalty entirely. But I understand that that is not the most popular of positions.
It's interesting that we were talking about, you know, the perverse nature of thinking about the grotesquery that surrounds it. Part of that is the entertainment culture that surrounds crime and death. We have turned it into an entertainment. In the last 2, 3 years, 4 years, particularly, but maybe executions, particularly of John, I believe it was John Wayne Gacy, became a public spectacle. We want to know what the last thing they ate was. We want to know, did they say anything? We want to know what the last thing that they did was. We've created it very similar to other situations where we've created an entertainment complex around crime and around punishment. And this has a lot to do with various trends that have happened, whether it's court TV that kind of came of age in the 1990s or the murder podcasts that happen now. And they're coming at a time when technology for these things is better than ever before. We've now found serial killers because their relatives are taking Ancestry.com DNA tests and then checking that little box that says you can send your DNA to a randomizer to see if it connects to any crime victim DNAs or criminal DNAs. And that's how we found the Golden State Killer. It's a very strange time where we're viewing what should be a moral and ethical and legal quandary in how much entertainment it's providing. To me, that is enough to kind of step back and say, maybe we really shouldn't be doing this because we're really using it as a cable TV show. And that defies the dignity of the human person in ways that are separate from the way the death penalty may defy the dignity of the human person or may underline the dignity of the human person, because many people think that maybe you should continue to have the death penalty because we view abortion as one of the worst possible crimes that occur, and that is the murder of innocence. And in this case, we have the murder of someone who decided to be guilty, and the state has said that it has the right to put this person to death, and the Catholic Church doesn't necessarily disagree with that in principle. So you have a lot of different ethical issues that are kind of meshing together.
I once knew a very, very thoughtful Protestant pastor who we were just talking about things, and I asked him about his opinion about the death penalty because he's just a very thoughtful guy. And I was like, you know what? I bet he has a unique perspective. And what he did, he did have a unique perspective. And that perspective was that when we talk about these sorts of cases, he was opposed to the death penalty not for the sort of for the reasons that were advanced by John Paul II and Pope Francis most recently, but for reasons of justice, in the sense that given the legal environment that we have in America, these cases, when they become death penalty cases, become highly litigated cases. And there are only so many judges, so many attorneys, so many clerks. You know, the wheels of justice are actually like, you know, wheels, and they become stuck and unstuck. And when cases like this take decades to resolve, that is time that gets taken away from other people's claims to justice that need to be adjudicated by the courts in a timely fashion. And I thought that was an interesting sort of additional layer of these perspectives to think about this is when you have a justice system that becomes so fixated on these very particular cases and distracted from its other duties, you can run into some real, real problems.
Let's move on to our final topic of the day. Dan, tell me about the Ayodhya Temple in India.
So the Ayodhya Temple in India is the Ram Mandir, which is a Hindu temple that it was until recently under construction in Ayodhya. this is the traditional birthplace of Ram. Many of you, if you watch sort of Bollywood entertainment, might be familiar with the Ramayana, which is the story of Ram and Sita. This is Ram's supposed birthplace. And Ram is venerated in various Hindu religious traditions as an avatar of the divine. This site was a mosque was built on this site in the 16th century, called the Babri Masjid. And this mosque remained in use for many, many centuries until in 1949, one day they open up and they find murtis of Ram and Sita inside. Hindu devotees had sort of desecrated the mosque in the eyes of its overseers, and the government of India sort of shut this down in the aftermath. India's constitutional heritage of religious freedom is much different than the United States. Certain religious communities are allowed to govern certain practices that we reserved for civil law, such as divorce. Muslims in India have different standards in civil divorce than do Hindus, and that's adjudicated by their community, and that sort of thing. So you have these tensions that build about this, and this becomes a sort of cause celeb for Hindu nationalists, that, you know, Ram is this great national symbol in addition to being a religious symbol. If you look at, you know, these epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, these are itihasa. They are considered like histories. So if we think about this, like in the life of the United in sort of compared to, you know, the United States, is this is kind of like the Bible, the great classical myths, the great historical epics of classic civilization, all rolled into one. And it's very religiously charged because this is a contested area between these religious communities. In 1992, this reaches a fevered pitch, and the mosque is destroyed by a mob that literally takes it apart brick by brick. In the wake of this, there is communal violence throughout India. Thousands of people die in riots, intercommunal religious riots. This sort of horrifies the nation, but this gets litigated and eventually goes to the Supreme Court, which finds that underneath this mosque, there is archaeological evidence of a pre-existing Hindu temple, and granted the rights to construct this temple. Now, fast forward today, all this sort of money has been raised. This temple is nearing completion. And in fact, just this month, on the 22nd of January, Prime Minister Modi of India played a part in the consecration of the particular Murti in this temple. And India is a place that, you know, we talked about this world, you know, of 1 billion Americans. There is a world of 1 billion Indians. This is the world's largest democracy. It is also the nation with one of the largest Muslim communities in the world. Muslims make up, you know, somewhere on the order of a fifth of the Indian population, but a fifth of, you know, over 1 billion people is hundreds of millions of people. And, you know, we talk a little bit about the Acton Institute. We've done a recent dialogue with Kevin Vallier, recent ALS, on these sort of anti-liberal religious alternatives to liberalism. And one of those that Kevin does not address in that book, but that is very much probably the most prominent example today, is this Hindu nationalism in India. And this is a story that I think is worth people's attention, even if they're not Hindus, even if they're not Indians, because these debates that oftentimes in religious circles in America happen in this very esoteric academic way, this is actually playing out. I mean, this is a prime minister dedicating a temple. The other interesting wrinkle to this story is that there were several Sankaracharyas who believed that this was done improperly and who believed that certain ritual requirements were not completed, and that in fact the reason for this consecration happening now is politically motivated. So you had, you know, imagine in a hypothetical integralist United States 100 years from now, the president of the United States dedicating a cathedral over the objections of several American cardinals. And this is the sort of drama you have unfolding in India, and it's fueled a lot of discussion there. And I think it's something that more Americans should be up to speed on.
We will put a link to the story that Dan had shared with me into the show notes so people can take a look at that. We did have some internet connectivity issues while we were recording this show, so we have lost Emily. So I want to close out with one more thing that I think it's necessary that we acknowledge. Of course, the Acton Institute is headquartered here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and last night the Detroit Lions were defeated by the San Francisco 49ers in a conference championship game in their bid to go to the Super Bowl. The bad news is that the Lions lost. But the good news is that the Lions lost a lot later in the season than they're used to losing. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that a lot of us have been, you know, I'm a New York Giants fan, but, you know, I work here with a lot of Lions fans, and of course know a lot of Lions fans here in Michigan, and for a long-suffering team like that to have a great season like this is the kind of thing that I wanted to make sure that we acknowledged. And it is setting up what is going to be a very interesting Super Bowl where we are going to, because we have to turn everything into an opportunity for people to give their hot takes. And apparently the fact that the world's biggest pop star is dating the tight end of one of the two teams playing in the Super Bowl is a problem. I have yet to really comprehend why this is something that I'm supposed to be angry about. As a fan of the National Hockey League and the sport of hockey, let me just be clear about this. I would love it if the world's biggest pop star were dating one of the stars of the National Hockey League and bringing all kinds of attention, billions of dollars worth of marketing value attention to the sport that I cared about. So I don't quite understand that part of it. But a great season by the Lions, and maybe sullied only by the boy, you never know if you're going to get back there again. And that's the kind of game that you really want to win if you're a Lions fan. But nonetheless, a great and maybe a little bit unexpectedly successful season from the Detroit Lions.
Listeners, you know, this is an audio podcast. I had not shaved or cut my hair since the Lions had a playoff berth. And I am freshly shaven. My garments are rent. My condolences to the Lions. But this is a very young team and a team with a lot of talent and a wonderful coach. And I look forward to next season.
Let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look right now in the show notes, where you'll find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find this program. Thanks to Dan. Thanks to Emily. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.